Let us start today with just a minute's quiet, quiet of the mind, complete quiet. All right, stop. Now, was it possible during these few seconds to let the mind be completely quiet and still? What does one notice? First and foremost, perhaps, the incapacity to let go, to relax the mind. One tries frantically not to try. Put it in another form, one tries frantically to keep the mind still, forcibly. Now this can never be done. The mind is still and quiet only naturally. That is to say, if the person is free within himself, the natural state of the mind is the state of complete quietness and peace. This does not necessarily mean that no thoughts will arise. But if thoughts arise, one is just a witness to those thoughts. And in being just a witness to those thoughts, you will find that those thoughts are not at all self-oriented, concerning oneself, concerning one's desires, plans, ambitions, anxieties, perplexities, and all the rest of it. That is the natural state. That is the healthy state of the mind, the utterly peaceful state. But that state represents the end point of the evolution of this organism, which is called a human being, as far as its psychical, its mental part is concerned. We have sufficient control over the body to remain quiet bodily and to remain quiet easily. We don't need any special effort. We can just relax, as we say, and sit quietly or lie quietly, doing nothing with the body. But we find it quite impossible to do that mentally. Now, I've said these things purely as an introduction to a very important point which we might consider this afternoon. We are always talking about our minds. Each person says my mind with reference to himself, your mind or his mind or her mind with reference to somebody else. Is there anything which in fact is my mind? Can I say my mind in the same sense that I say my piano, my house, my pen or my books? Can I say it in quite that sense? Can I say it even in the sense in which I say my heart, my liver, my bones? Consider this very carefully. And recall that last time we examined this question of the body and how we all say my body. And we tried to see that this body, which is made up of elements which are drawn from the world's stock of certain fundamental elements, this body, made up in that manner, does not remain as such changeless through one's life. It is constantly changing. The various atoms are being replaced. Perhaps the atoms which are least replaced, if at all, may be the atoms which compose the bones. Calcium, phosphorus, and the oxygen, calcium phosphate and so forth, and other metallic and non-metallic ingredients of the bones. They may perhaps stay put throughout one's life, but there's nothing else in the body which stays put. It is impermanent. There is fresh material coming in, and there is old material constantly going out of the system. And we saw, therefore, that this phrase, my body, has only a very limited significance and meaning. And we went further and tried to see that if one has a sense of ownership, proprietorship over the body, then it is associated with vanity, with egoism, with possessiveness, anxiety, fear, and all kinds of things like that. The property sense, the sense of exclusive ownership, with all the rights and so on which are attached to it, inevitably implies a conflict with the so-called other. And we also tried to see that if one can be free of this illusion of ownership of the body is there unquestionably, we all know that. But if we are free of the illusion of ownership over this body, then that sense of ownership gives place to trusteeship. And in being the trustee of the body, one's whole physical life, as well as several aspects of one's psychical life, undergo very great change. Change which releases health, wholeness, in the true sense of the word. We cease to care in the wrong way for the body. We cease to neglect and be careless of the body. It's a trust in our hands, and it is our duty to fulfill that trust to perfection as far as lies in our power. Now, the body is not, each person is not just a material body. We call him, quite rightly, a psychophysical organism. As regards the psychical part, the mental part, do we own a mind? Does the phrase "my mind" have any sort of substantial reality to it? Look at it this way. Supposing one is considering another person and his behavior. The tendency, quite naturally and simply, is to look at the psychophysical processes that take place where that person is. One is looking at Mr. John Smith. Very good. Mr. John Smith is a psychophysical organism. And if one observes quite objectively, then one just analyzes the processes which give the appearance which is named John Smith. The appearance is quite solid, quite real. It's not a ghost or something. It is there. Yes. A physical body is a physical body. It's solid. It is there. And the way the person thinks and utters his thought, the feelings that he goes through, they are also there. They are quite real. But is there an entity which can be called his mind? And if we look objectively, we tend not to feel about the other person in terms of his mind, his property. But with respect to ourselves, oh no, that's quite different. I have got a mind, I say. I'd be very upset if somebody told me, no, it's an illusion. But look carefully into this. The fact of the matter is, I have not got a mind. There are processes going on which are mental processes. Thoughts, feelings, and so forth. Would these thoughts and feelings be there, supposing there were no material body? They couldn't possibly be there, can they? Have you ever seen disembodied thoughts and feelings floating about and addressing you and saying, hello, it's a long time since I've seen you. See, this psychophysical organism is an integrated whole. It is not a synthesized organism. It is not an organism which is made up by collecting different parts out of the universe, one part being called mind or thoughts or feelings or ideas or conceptions, and then screwed on, nutted and bolted onto a body made up of bones and skin and blood and all the rest of it collected from somewhere else. It is not a manufactured thing. But you know, we live through our lives as if it were a manufactured thing, a mechanical thing, a put together. Oneself is a living organism, and its livingness and its continued livingness is a phenomenon of wholeness through integration and not through mechanical synthesis. Now, this is a very important point to grasp. If we understand this, so many mistakes we make with respect to ourselves and with respect to our neighbors and all that happens in our life would be out of it. So much trouble, unnecessary trouble which we heap upon ourselves would not be there. We have this tremendous sense of ownership, possessiveness. My mind. One can more legitimately speak of my body with some substantial meaning associated with the phrase. But my mind is totally insubstantial. It just isn't there. We do not know really the mystery and the process of the action of that mystery by which the whole world, as we call it, inanimate as well as animate, has come into being. We class ourselves amongst the animates. We are alive. And we as human beings have, as commonly said, minds, consciousness, spirit, soul. We use words like that. But they are all words of convenience only. And they are words which convey more our ignorance than our enlightened understanding of the reality. I haven't got a mind, a soul, a spirit, a character. I will even go further and say, I haven't got a body. Still further, this word I, which I use in common parlance, is a misnomer. But by virtue of the fact that we are what we are, it is a convenient starting point to use words like I and you in the conventional way, although it is a misleading way. We have no option in the matter. If, for instance, we constantly referred to ourselves by name and the other person by his or her name, our conversation would become a little bit cumbrous, to say the least. It's much easier to say I and you. But our real starting point, if we are concerned with reality, with understanding, our real starting point is to be aware of the fact that we do not know. There is a curious, positive nescience, not knowledge, not knowing, which underlies all this process which we believe we know or understand. But as and when I wake up to the fact that I do not know, then there is the beginning of wisdom. For instance, the sciences of physiology, anatomy, and so on have progressed wonderfully in the last few centuries and decades and centuries. But do we know this extraordinary mystery which is life? What we really know, we can control, we can do, we can bring into being. Can I bring life into being? Apart from the natural process of procreation, but I do not know the mystery by which procreation takes place at all. And I have no control over it really. I'm only a participant in a process which brings another human being into the world. That is all. And no more. I don't know it as I know how to play some Beethoven or Chopin or whatever it is. You see what I mean? Similarly, with respect to this thing which we call the mind, I don't know it in that sense. I can't bring it into being. Certain processes go on. Mental processes which one can observe. Now, if I'm awake to the fact that actually I do not know, what happens? My mind remains open. And in remaining open in that way, it is open in terms of complete freedom. Now notice, in saying this, I have used the phrase, my mind. See? Talking is always extremely difficult. However, let's go on. The mind remains open. And it remains open in freedom. And in that openness in freedom, growth in the real sense can take place. How does the newborn infant grow? The mystery of that process, I don't know. Similarly, I do not know the mystery of the growth of the mind. Now you may recall that during the last 3 or 4 years it has been suggested that we might approach the understanding of the nature of mind in a new way. Not altogether new, but more or less a new way. Mind is a word to denote the receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes the organism, the living organism. The living organism receives stimuli and impressions. It is able to take them in, to absorb them. The brain performs its task, organizes, categorizes, tabulates, pigeonholes, concepts get formed, and so on. all this out of the stimuli that one receives. And then there is that other aspect. Not only does one receive, but one also responds. And if you look at mind, the phenomenon of the mental processes which take place in ourselves, very carefully, you will find that in that way of understanding, the receptive, responsive sensitivity of the organism, perhaps we've got a fairly inclusive understanding of the nature of the mind. Now, this sensitivity is the personal aspect. Each living organism has this sensitivity. But there is another aspect. What we think has power. Our thoughts and feelings are intimately associated with our desires. We pride ourselves upon being very objective-minded, matter-of-fact and all the rest of it. If one scratches sufficiently below the surface, one finds that this is an error. We are not at all objective in that sense. The intellect, on the whole, is the slave of desire. You watch your life very carefully. The things that one plans out, as one says, quite dispassionately. The planning is far from dispassionate, far from it. It's subtly interwoven with desire, either desire which is rampant or desire which is somewhat quieter. But being quieter, very often, it is more powerful than rampant desire. And the intellect is all the time serving desire. Whence does desire spring? Is it my desire? Consider this carefully. This individual organism, which I call myself, is constantly receiving stimuli from outside, impressions from outside. It is also receiving stimuli through my own memories, through my anticipations, and so forth. But these stimuli, apart from those which come from within oneself, all come from outside. Stimuli through the avenues of the senses, sights, sounds, touches, tastes, and all the rest of it. And the response, or shall I say, the reaction to those stimuli is largely in terms of desire, almost entirely in terms of attraction or repulsion, attachment or aversion. You see, the process of the body, which is an organic living process, is nevertheless very much imprisoned within this mechanical reacting to the stimuli. Very largely, we behave like machines. If we are told to stand up, up we stand. If we are told to sit down, down we sit. And then we say, my mind on top of all that. And yet, our thoughts and feelings are a tremendous power moving us to action throughout the day and every day. So that mind in itself, whatever it may be, in its personal aspect, its limited finite aspect, is a sensitivity of the organism. In its universal aspect, is an extraordinary power, an energy. And this mind, which is power, which is energy, in its natural state, is in perfect peace and harmony. It is when the sensitivity aspect of mind, functioning through me, the individual, misfunctions in me, then that power becomes destructive. The whole process of living is a dangerous process. And no one can avoid it. The very existence of the body depends upon the activity of innumerable energies. I'm talking in the terms of the physicist only. Innumerable energies at play. Electrical, heat, light, gravitational, and all the rest of it. Intra-atomic and on the gross scale the collection of atoms, which is a mass. All these forces are at play, and the mechanism of the body, the way the body behaves and functions goes on. Now similarly, just as there are these energies, there are also other energies which we lump under the word mind. Energy of a nature which is not measurable. This is the very important part to grasp. That energy which we name mind, in the universal sense, or if you like to use the word soul or spirit, or call it what you like, it doesn't matter. The word is merely a sound to represent some reality. That energy is non-measurable. That energy, being non-measurable, has no dimensions, it has no forms, but it gives rise to forms. Our thoughts, our ideas, beliefs, conceptions, and so forth. Now, how does it give rise to these forms? This is where mind and matter meet, don't they? In the living person. Body, matter, and this mystery, mind, has its own way of functioning, we don't know how, of affecting this body. Various stimuli are in operation, various reactions take place, and because of our power of speech, the sight impressions, the sound impressions, and all the different sense impressions are coordinated and made into a particular pattern, what we call a thought our ideas, our conceptions, and all the rest of it. And this is completely tied up with our desires, which have, I suppose, the ductless glands and all the rest of it come into the story here to determine it all. So, this immeasurable, dimensionless, formless, indescribable, unimaginable power, which we call mind, interacts this way to produce the mental phenomena which are observable in the life of a living being. That's how the mental phenomena are produced. Or at least I'm trying to suggest how the mental phenomena are produced. Is there anything like my mind then? In actual fact, apart from the phrase my mind being a convenient phrase for pragmatic purposes, just in ordinary everyday use, it has no reality to it. This body, which is made up of atoms drawn from the universal stock of similar atoms, or if you like to go still deeper, of energies, as the physicist would say, all matter is ultimately electrical in nature. This is more or less the position to which physics has come. 10 years' time, in a century, physics may say something still more, you see, having gone still deeper. When this body perishes, back into that world stock will go these atoms. They will be unidentifiable. There'll be no entity, Feroz Mehta. There'll be no label attached to each atom. This belongs to Feroz Mehta. Please preserve in blue bottles or on the top shelf. You see? No such thing. They are quite indistinguishable from each other. All the chemical atoms of any one element are quite indistinguishable from each other. No one can claim them as an owner. These are my hydrogen atoms and my iron atoms. And if you go still deeper, all chemical atoms lose their identity in terms of protons and electrons and neutrons and so on. They just lose their identity altogether. It's completely impossible to distinguish one electron from another. And to make the story still more perplexing and difficult, and inducing one to give it up and say, well, I give it up, I can't pursue it further. This electron is not an entity. It is just a sort of a cloud, an energy cloud, which suggests that something which we name the electron might be located there. It has never been seen, it has never been caught in a trap. You can't do anything with it. Still less can you do anything with these wonderful things called neutrinos, which are even more elusive. So much for matter, which we think we really know and grasp and catch hold of. Solid stuff, as we call it. How much more so with respect to what we call my mind, my thoughts, feelings, ideas, beliefs, conceptions, and the whole host of them. And yet we cling to them. We cling to them hard. This is my idea. I copyright it. Anyone who quotes without permission will have to pay so much as a fine or damages or whatever it is. I am the owner of the idea. Am I? How absurd. What happens when I cling to ideas, beliefs, doctrines? Let me look at the ideas. They are only strings of words, aren't they? What is the mental content underlying them? Is it something which I can say, this is mine? Not at all. That mental content is undergoing continuous change. It is insubstantial. That cloud in the sky there, goodness knows where the molecules of water vapor and so on, and the dust particles involved in it will be in another half hour or so. If there's a bit of a mist in my garden, as I say, can I lay claim to ownership over that mist? To lay claim to ownership over ideas and beliefs is very much like that. Or to claim ownership in a different sense by saying that, this is the truth. And we must uphold this truth with every ounce of our strength to the end of our days. We must, if necessary, lay down our lives in war, battle against he who opposes this truth. But now see how tragically this has worked in world history. Men have been destructive, cruel, anything but men, anything but human, defending what they call, what they conceive is freedom, truth, justice, honor, beauty, humanity, brotherhood. See the amount of evil that takes place in the name of love. How man is constantly hurting his fellow man because of this something which he names love. Think of the jealousies involved, the passion to possess, to dominate, to limit, demanding reciprocity, and so forth. The feeling of love, the idea of love. And isn't that the same with goodness and truth and the right way to live and so forth? But you see, when considering this, we must see it as within ourselves all the time. It is my mind and heart. Now, how strongly I use the phrase, my mind. But you understand in which sense I'm using it. It is my mind and heart which are impure, which are clumsy, unskilled, which produce all this pain and evil in the world. All the time. See, mind is a tremendous power, isn't it? Mind in itself, therefore. And if all the beliefs and conceptions which lumped together I describe as my mind. If I don't hold fast to all of them, but remain as an open channel, then there is the possibility of purification going on, of wholeness being released. Now, several of us present, many of us, perhaps all of us, are interested in the teachings of the Buddha. We are interested in the words. We get hold of the words. And we say, there you are, the enlightened one said so. Do I know what the enlightened ones, what the enlightened one had in his mind? Do I know the content of his mind? I can only know the content of my mind. Unless and until one releases those faculties which lie dormant in us, by which one can enter into another person's mind, as we say, and know the content of his mind as it is in his mind, we only know the content in our own minds. And yet we will take the words of a great teacher and flaunt them about. The Buddha said so and so. Jesus said so and so. Now, I'm going to do just that. The Buddha said, feelings, perceptions, the patterns of ideas and systems of philosophy which you build up out of those perceptions and so on, and discriminative consciousness itself are all changing. They are impermanent. They are in themselves dukkha, suffering, ill, the ill state. They are without ultimate reality, anatta, in themselves. These are ephemeral passing appearances. Therefore, he said, with right wisdom, do not grasp them. Let them go. But do we do that? Think of these two phrases by which we live all day and every day. My body, my mind. Look deeply into the attitude underlying those two phrases. When I say my body, it's in a possessive sense. This thing. The same with the phrase my mind, in a possessive sense. My thinking processes, my ideas, the book I'm writing, the lectures I'm giving, and all the rest of the humbug. You see, this is something which we must not merely think about. Thinking about it is a necessary step. But thinking about it is merely like going to the greengrocer and buying your potatoes and cabbages and so on. But you know, you've got to do a lot more with those cabbages and potatoes before it will become a healthful, life-giving meal for you. a lot more. So thinking about it is just that. Think about it. And watch the thought process which takes place. Watch it very carefully and see how selfness is constantly tied up with it all. This preservation of an I entity which is not there. The I is simply a mental process of abstraction of an entity which is non-existent. It is a naming process only. And if we recognize that I, the word I, is only a naming process and is not a reality in itself, we shall have taken a very useful step towards freedom from all egoism. And therefore from all self-orientation. And therefore from conflict. When this I sense is not involved, then if I present some idea and my neighbor has quite a different idea, I do not defend my idea. I do not take sides with my idea against my neighbor's idea. This is the psychology of the situation, isn't it? Arguments, discussions, and so on, where do they lead? And what do they express? The egoism in one at war with the egoism in another. Therefore they have furious arguments. Perfectly right and proper in the early years of one's life when one is growing towards the release of full egohood. Don't let's forget that. You can't realize freedom from egoism, unless there is an ego to be free from. The first task of the child is to become self-conscious and to recognize himself, I am I. See? But assuming, unfortunately, it happens very rarely, assuming that the right influences have been at play, that child will realize full egohood in the right way, which means he will realize his individuality, that the indivisible wholeness which is he himself. He'll be healthy, he'll be balanced, he'll be intelligent, he'll be sensible. He'll be something which may rightly be called a human being at his stage. But individuality, the non-divisibility, doesn't stop there. That is as far as the individual, that particular organism is concerned. But that particular organism doesn't live by virtue of itself. It lives by virtue of the fact that there is the whole world which interacts with it and keeps it alive. Take away other men, take away animals, take away plants, take away the earth. And where am I? Non-existent altogether. I subsist because the totality subsists. So now, in the next great growth is in the realization of the indivisibility from the totality. And when I realize that indivisibility, realize it in the innermost deeps of my consciousness, not just as an interesting intellectual idea. When that happens, at last I am the true individual. And a true individual is one through whom totality functions freely and harmoniously and perfectly. He is a light unto the world, not merely a light unto himself. There is no such thing as being a light unto oneself merely. But if that kind of realization emerges, try and feel this out. What has happened to that true individual's body-mind organism and his relationship, his attitude towards it? Instead of my body and my mind in the possessive sense, in the sense of ownership, he is trustee for it. And if one is a trustee for one's thoughts and feelings and ideas, how careful one has to be with regard to what one thinks, feels, speaks, and so forth. But you see, what this implies for the individual himself. It implies perfect freedom. A freedom which has not been acquired, but a freedom which has been realized, that is to say, made real at last. That freedom is from the very beginning. That sort of individual is the individual who can love. Who loves, in fact. He doesn't fall in love. Because if you fall in love, you can fall out of it. And then that is not love. Love is as universal as space. Love is as universal as the one total reality. He loves. He is wise. He is naturally good. He doesn't have to strive to be good. When the self-orientation has disappeared altogether, and he's awake and in harmony with his total environment, then he is like that. These things cannot be sought, because they are not away from us. They are our essential nature. And this is something which we may see only as an idea, as words. But it has to be something immensely more than that. You know how little children sometimes, perhaps more particularly little girls, when they are talking with each other, they'll say, oh, I'm going to marry thus, thus, and thus at such and such an age, etc. This is the little girl talking. She has no conception whatever. All right, so much for the talking. Go and marry and see how different it is, the reality. Get hold of the realization. But you see, it is potential here and now. Our freedom, this transcendent love and wisdom and beauty which is everywhere, all the time, is here right from the beginning. It's not the sort of thing we have to go out and seek. Why do we seek at all? Because we want to possess something, to own something, to gain something, to achieve, to attain. This is the curse of humanity. All human beings are cursed with this passion to possess, to gain, to achieve, to attain, to express themselves, as they call it. Look at the real great artists, the real great creators in the world. They produced immortal beauty because they couldn't help producing it. And was it they who did it? Not at all. they were awake to the fact that there is that, the supreme, the total, the eternal, the unknown and unknowable mystery which worked through them. And so their lives were burnt up. But a burning which produced no smoke, but only light and friendly warmth in the burning. And they produced immortal beauty. Or rather, immortal beauty emerged through them. And that is the secret of our living too. Our task is just to be awake. Just keep awake. And in your sleep too, you will keep awake. You know that if you really live through the day, wholly attentive, then when you go to sleep, that attentiveness is there, watchful, mindful, in a form which doesn't come through into the brain consciousness. But it is there. Take a simple analogy. Here, whilst we are awake and in this room, we know that the bodily, that the, all the life processes of the body are going on. Don't we? That is why this body is here, alive. You are all listening, I am talking, and so forth. When I go to sleep, those life processes are going on, in some respects much more efficiently than now, but I don't know about it. This is a very important thing. Why do we have the passion to know consciously? This is a possessiveness. I want to know. Tell me. So you see, my mind, my body, etc. Let's be free of the illusion of ownership of possessiveness. And you will find that with that, all grasping, all resentment, and all tendency to dominate other people, other bodies that is, and other lives and the process of their life, their way of life, their ideas, their conceptions and so forth, all that will change. One of the pathetic mistakes throughout history, and practically all societies, religions and so forth are tainted with this, is the passion to go out and convert. I'll tell you a silly story. In my young days, I had such a strong missionary spirit, I thought I'll convert my dog. And I lectured unto him. He only barked at me. A little parable is sometimes very useful. You see, all that, I mention this because, as we know, some of the most terrible wars and cruelties in history have been in the name of converting the other to the true faith. But we'd be free of all that. Now, if I may suggest something, during the coming fortnight, meditate on this, not in terms of just thinking about it, churning the ocean of words about it all, but just try the experiment. Try and be aware of the I. We use this word I constantly. And whatever our intellects may accept superficially, this feeling of I is most deeply ingrained in us. One of its commonest manifestations is the sense of elation one feels when one can say to oneself, "Oh, I did that well." And the sense of misery and annoyance and frustration one feels when one says, "Oh, I made a muck of that." Isn't that true? You see how deeply ingrained this I is? So, try and be aware of this I and just see what happens. Having said all this, I will end up by saying there is a real meaning to the word I. Find that out.